Welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's narration is Deportation and Colonization, Part 2. The United States government, on its own account, made two distinct efforts to settle Negroes outside of the United States. One colony was to be planted in Central America, and another on Isle Avache, or Cow Island, near the southwest coast of Haiti. President Lincoln was most interested in the proposed Central American settlement, and used his influence with Congress and with the leading free Negroes to secure a colony there. He brought the matter up frequently in cabinet meetings, but most of the members were opposed. On August 14, 1862, a delegation of Negroes was invited to see Lincoln in regard to the proposed Central American settlement. Colonization was necessary, he told them plainly, because the blacks and whites were so different that each suffered from contact with the other. In this country, the Negroes were nowhere given equal rights, so let them go where they would have equality. Except for slavery, there would have been no war, and further trouble might be expected if the races remained together. For a few leading Negroes living in comfort to oppose a colonization was selfish. They ought to sacrifice their own comfort for the good of the race. If the free Negroes would go away, the whites would be willing to emancipate all. The more capable Negroes ought to go first, not the newly freed, and Liberia was a good place, though at present he, Lincoln, was thinking of Central America, where the white people had no objection to the blacks, and where the blacks could hope for equality. The border state congressmen were assured by the president that if their states would emancipate the Negroes, plenty of room could be found for them in Central America. Doolittle and Pomeroy began active efforts to find Negroes for a colony, and Pomeroy issued an address to the Negroes of the United States, advising them to accept the president's suggestions. In a letter to Doolittle, to whom he gave credit for the passage of the colonization laws, Pomeroy gave his views on the matter. Others, he said, wanted only freedom for the blacks. He himself wanted rights and enjoyments for them. Can he secure them with the white man? What are the teachings of 250 years of history? Only this, that the free coloured men of the free states are doomed to a life of servile labour, no hope of elevation. I am for the Negroes securing his rights and his nationality in the clime of his nativity on the soil of the tropics. Nothing will restore this union but a probable solution of the problem. What shall be the destiny of the coloured race on this continent? At first, Lincoln was anxious to purchase territory for settlement in order that the United States government might exercise control over the Negro colonies. But he was prevented from doing this in Central America by the Clayton-Bulwer Treaty, which prohibited the United States from exercising control over any part of Central America. When A.W. Thompson of the Chiriquois Improvement Company, endorsed by Pomeroy, offered to colonize Negroes in the Chiriquois province, New Granada, Lincoln wished to accept the offer. Thompson claimed to have control of 2 million acres on the isthmus beyond the boundary of Central America, i.e. below Costa Rica, and thus not subject to the terms of the Clayton-Bulwer Treaty. The land contained some coal deposits, and Thompson was anxious to secure a contract to supply the Navy with coal. Gideon Welles, Secretary of the Navy, wrote in his diary that on September 11, 1862, Senator Pomeroy's scheme for deporting Negroes to Chiriquois came up for discussion in the President's cabinet. Welles was opposed to Thompson's project, and he believed that Pomeroy had a financial interest in it. Under the date of September 26, 1862, Welles recorded that at several recent cabinet meetings the subject of deportation had been discussed. In fact, he stated that it had been under discussion almost from the beginning of the administration. The president was in earnest about the matter, wished to send the Negroes out of the country, Smith, with the Thompsons, urged and stimulated him, and they were as importunate with me as the President. Lincoln, Blair and Smith favoured the Chiriquai scheme, while Wells, who pronounced it a fraud and a cheat, with Chase, Stanton and Bates opposed it, the latter only because Thompson's title to the land was disputed. On September 23rd, Lincoln asked each member of his cabinet to consider seriously the subject of acquiring territory to which the Negroes might be deported. He thought it essential to provide an asylum for a race which we had emancipated, but which could never be recognised or admitted to be our equals. Blair and Bates were in favour of compulsory deportation, while the other members of the cabinet believed that voluntary emigration would solve the problem. Lincoln, however, had accepted the offer of Senator Pomeroy to supervise the work of colonisation without charge, and a contract was made with Thompson on September 12, 1862, so framed as to safeguard the rights of the Negroes. It contained the following provisions. Pomeroy, or some other agent of the President, was to investigate conditions and supervise the settlement. Thompson was to be responsible for the conduct of the colonists, and the United States was not to be compromised with New Granada. Equality of citizenship was to be secured for the blacks. Thompson was to give land with good titles to the Negroes, 20 acres to each adult male, 40 acres to the head of a family with 5 children, and 80 acres to each head of family with more than 5 children. The United States would pay the costs of surveying the lands, and as fast as the land should be settled, the government would pay $1 per acre for not more than 100,000 acres, 30% of the payments to go to Thompson, and 70% to be used in making roads and wharves. Furthermore, when Pomeroy should report that one settlement had been made, then the United States would advance Thompson $50,000 to aid in the development of coal mines, this sum to be repaid in coal for the use of the United States Navy. To Pomeroy was given control of the expedition and its finances. Secretary Smith instructed him that his expenses, but no salary, would be paid, that he was authorised to organise the colony and supervise it, and that if he found Chiriquai unsuited, he might take the Negroes elsewhere, though not to Guatemala or Salvador, which had raised vigorous objections to Negro colonisation. The Treasury Department immediately placed $25,000 at the disposal of Pomeroy. During the month of September 1862, he paid $14,000 of this amount to Thompson, and on April 4, 1864, he paid Thompson and W.E. Gaylord $8,732, this being the remainder of the $25,000. He himself had expended about $2,300. Secretary Seward sent circulars to the Central American states and to England, France, Denmark and the Netherlands, countries which had tropical colonies, inviting negotiations and suggestions with respect to colonisation. From the Central American governments came prompt responses. They wanted no Negro colonies which would be under any sort of control by the United States, and most of them objected to any kind of Negro colonisation. In October, Pomeroy wrote to Doolittle, "I have 13,700 applicants. I have selected of them 500 for a pioneer party." But Seward, he said, had stopped the colonisation on account of the attitude of the governments in Central America. Professor Joseph Henry of the Smithsonian Institution helped to put an end to the Chiriquai scheme by declaring that the coal on Thompson's property was worthless, and the Central American states not only protested against colonisation, but denied the legality of Thompson's title to the land. So ended the attempt to settle Negroes in Central America. What became of the $25,000 is not known. Pomeroy's accounts had not been settled in 1870. He seems to have lost Lincoln's confidence, and there is no evidence that many Negroes were sent to Chiriquai. The colonization on Isle Avache promised to be more successful than the Central American attempt. Of several propositions to carry Negroes to Haiti, Lincoln preferred that of Bernard Koch or Koch, who had leased Isle of Ashe from the Haitian government for 20 years. The island was about 12 miles from Oakes on the mainland, contained about 100 square miles, had good soil for cotton culture, and was not subject to epidemics. On December 31, 1862, Lincoln, anxious to get the colonization experiment started, made a contract with Coach to carry 5,000 Negroes to his island for $50 per head. Coach was to secure from the Haitian government a guarantee of equal rights for the blacks, furnish them houses, gardens, and food, build churches and schools, and give them employment under white superintendents at wages ranging from $4 to $10 a month. Coke took this contract to New York and Boston capitalists and asked for financial support. He proposed to carry 500 Negroes out at once and to raise in 1863 1,000 bales of Sea Island cotton, which would be worth, at the prices then prevailing, nearly $1 million. The outlay, he thought, need not be more than $70,000. The capital was promised, several hundred Negroes were ready to go, a ship was chartered and supplies collected at Fortress Monroe. But the opponents of Negro colonization now asserted that Coke was in league with Admiral Semmes to abduct and re-enslave the Negroes, and that he was of doubtful character. Consequently, Lincoln cancelled the contract. Certain New York capitalists, Jerome, Forbes, and Tuckerman, who had subscribed to the Coke Company, were so impressed with the scheme that they purchased the Haitian lease and then sought to obtain a contract from the government similar to that made with Coke. Usher, who had succeeded Smith as Secretary of the Interior, was assured that the contractors were reliable men, and the contract was made by him with Forbes and Tuckerman on April 6, 1863. By this agreement, the Negroes were to be looked after for 5 years by the contractors, and upon proof of successful settlement, the United States was to pay $50 per head for each Negro colonist. The contractors intended to send Coke out as governor, and the money was furnished by Jerome, who for some reason was in bad repute with the government. But of the connection between the two men and the contractors, the government authorities knew nothing at the time. Tuckerman, in 1886, asserted that Lincoln pressed the contract upon Forbes and himself, urged that they, as a personal favour, accept it and help him carry out the plan which he had so much at heart. Unwillingly, he says, they agreed to ship the first 500 Negroes for whom provision had already been made. An expedition was started at once for Isle of Ashe. The Ocean Ranger left Fortress Monroe with about 500 Negroes, the poor refugees, according to Tuckerman, flocking on board, shouting hallelujahs, and in some instances falling on their knees in thanksgiving for the promised blessings in store for them. Coke, the governor or manager, with several white superintendents, accompanied the Negroes to the island. On the voyage, the Negroes were not well cared for, smallpox broke out, and 20 or 30 persons died, among them several of the whites. The blacks had to purchase drinking water from the ship's steward, and the food was bad. They were landed during the rainy season, but found no houses and but little lumber out of which to construct them, and were forced to build rude huts for shelter. Coke brought no supplies, no seeds, and no implements, but being charged with the discipline of the colony, he brought handcuffs, leg chains, and stocks. He proved to be despotic and incompetent, and some of the Negroes were maimed for life by his harsh discipline. He managed to get all the coin money that the Negroes had and paid them for their work, only in paper money which he had printed. The exasperated blacks finally drove him off. When his employers, who cared only for the promised 1,000 bales of cotton, heard of this, they stopped the meagre supplies which they had been sending and left the Negroes to shift for themselves. Tuckerman's account of 1886 does not agree with the above, which is based on the records of the Interior Department. He says that no sooner were the survivors landed and the necessity for manual labour on their part apparent than the lowest characteristics of the Negro Indolence, discontent, insubordination, and finally revolt prevailed. Mistaking liberty for license, they refused to work and raised preposterous demands for luxuries to which they were wholly unaccustomed during servitude. He further states that discontent was fostered by the natives, who wished the colonists to desert and become Haitian subjects. This we refused to allow the freed men to do. To Lincoln, the failure of this enterprise was a bitter disappointment. Soon after the Ocean Ranger had sailed for Haiti, the State Department learned that Bernard Koch was the prime mover in the expedition, and that Leonard Jerome had furnished the capital. Secretary Usher at once informed Tuckerman and Forbes that they might count upon no more contracts, for the connection of Koch and Jerome with the undertaking was regarded as an act of bad faith to the United States. From Confederate newspapers, Lincoln learned that the Negroes had been neglected, and he caused remonstrances to be made to the contractors. Jerome now came forward and avowed his intention to expend no more money for the Negroes. Usher tried to hold Tuckerman and Forbes to their contract, but soon found that they were acting only for Jerome. He charged Tuckerman and Forbes with acting in bad faith throughout the transaction and informed them that no money would be paid until the contract was carried out. To Jerome, he wrote, "Candor induces me to inform you that when your name was proposed as one of the contracting parties by Mr. Tuckerman, I declined to have it inserted in the contract, because I did not think that your avocation and habits of life would induce you to persevere in the enterprise if it should prove disastrous and unprofitable." Reports of bad conditions in the colony continued to come in, and Lincoln was troubled by the accounts of the sufferings of the Negroes. Finally, D.C. Donahue of Greencastle, Indiana, was sent in October 1863 to investigate conditions on the island. In his report to the Secretary of the Interior, he described the situation of the blacks as deplorable, and their treatment by Koch and his men as inhuman. Instead of preparing to care for the Negroes for 5 years, as they had agreed, the contractors had already ceased to furnish supplies. Donahue found 378 Negroes out of about 500 who had been carried from Fortress Monroe, and for several months he supplied them at the expense of the United States government. He thought that the principal cause of the failure was mismanagement, for the soil was good, and cotton could be profitably raised. Then too, the Haitians were opposed to the colony. Koch had not received permission to colonize the island, nor had anything been done to secure citizenship for the colonists. Another difficulty in the way of successful colonization lay in the fact that the American blacks were quite different from the Haitians in language, customs, religion, and ideas of government. The Negroes wanted to return to the United States, and the Haitians were anxious for them to go. It was Donahue's opinion that a successful colony could not then be developed in Haiti. Reluctantly, Lincoln abandoned his second serious attempt at colonizing the blacks, and on February 8, 1864, he requested Stanton to send a ship to bring the Cow Island colonists back to the refugee camps in the District of Columbia. For some reason, practically all of the colonization work had been done more or less in secrecy. When the Ocean Ranger took the 500 Negroes from Fortress Monroe to Haiti, there were few who knew what was being done, and hence there arose the widespread rumor that the Negroes were simply kidnapped and turned over to the Confederates. Even more secret was the bringing back of the colonists. The ship Maria L. Day was chartered at New York and provisioned as for a voyage to Aspinwall to take on 500 United States troops returning from California. Captain Edward L. Hartz was placed in charge, with directions to proceed towards Aspinwall and with sealed orders which he was to open when he reached 20 degrees north latitude. He found 293 Negroes on the island under Donahue's care. The others had died or wandered away. Clothes were distributed to the destitute, and on March 4, 1864, the return trip was begun. On March 20th, the colonists were landed at Alexandria, Virginia, and the venture was at an end. For several years, the contractors made efforts to collect their expenses from the United States government, but did not succeed. Although Lincoln still believed in the necessity for colonization, the failure of the Cow Island colony prejudiced the blacks against such attempts and strengthened the efforts of those whites who now opposed colonization and favored the incorporation of the Negroes into the American population. In December 1862, Lincoln had stated in his message that the failure of the Central American scheme had disappointed many Negroes who wanted to leave the United States, and that only two places were left to which they might go, Liberia and Haiti, but that they were unwilling to go to these places. Now, after the failure of the Koch expedition, Haiti was out of the question. The Secretary of the Interior in December 1863 reported that the Negroes were no longer willing to leave the United States and that they were needed in the army. For these reasons, he thought that they should not be forcibly deported. Referring to some attempts to settle Negroes in the North, he declared that much prejudice has been manifested throughout most of the free states in regard to the introduction of colored persons. Yet he thought it might be possible to use them in constructing the Pacific railways where labor was needed and where there would be no objection to them. In Congress, opinion was turning against colonization, and in March 1864, Senator Wilkinson introduced a bill to repeal all measures making appropriations for deportation of Negroes. He declared that these attempts had been the most extreme folly, and that the results had been hazardous and disgraceful. On July 2, 1864, Lincoln signed an act repealing all the laws relating to Negro colonization. The Interior Department gradually discontinued its emigration office. In May 1863, Usher attempted to get rid of Reverend James Mitchell, whom Lincoln had appointed as agent of emigration, but Mitchell continued in office for a year longer. Usher complained that Mitchell, without permission, corresponded in the name of the department on emigration matters. He was forbidden to do this, and the records of his office were called for. These he refused to give up, and he was discharged at the end of June 1864. For months he besieged the Secretary of the Interior for an extra year's salary, but finally dropped out of the records in 1865. When in 1870 the House called for the accounts of the emigration agents, it was found that $38,000 had been expended by them. Of this, $25,000 had been paid to Senator Pomeroy, and the remainder had been expended by other agents. The American Colonization Society returned in 1864 the $25,000 that it had received in 1863. After the failure of foreign colonization, the advocates of separation of the races suggested that sections of the South be set apart for the Negroes. Some thought that South Carolina and Georgia should be given them, others that the lower Mississippi Valley should be cleared of whites and divided among the ex-slaves. A third proposition was that in each southern state a section should be set apart for the blacks. Senator Lane of Kansas strongly advocated a bill to set apart for the blacks that part of Texas bounded by the Rio Grande, the Gulf, the Colorado River of Texas, and the Llano Estacado. Lane thought that the Negroes should be forced to go to this region at their own expense. The United States might use, he said, the $600,000 already appropriated to purchase titles, might carry colored troops out there and discharge them, and then send their families to them. Thus would be formed the nucleus of a Negro state. He stated the following reasons for favoring colonization. The North was opposed to the Negro as a laborer and wanted no mixture of races. In the South, the whites would hate the ex-slaves whom they had so mistreated. The sentiment in favor of Negro rights, now so strong, would in time die out, and the Negro would be left with no chance for social or political equality. At the end of the war, there would be a surplus of labor due to the discontinuance of war industries and to the discharge of soldiers. It would be impossible to give to the Negroes the lands of their masters and to secure quiet titles, for even if the southern men were killed, the women and children would remain and after amnesty would hold the lands. I had hoped, he said, the time should come when the footprints of the white man should not be found on the soil of South Carolina. But in this matter, the best interest of the blacks must be considered. Lane's bill was favourably reported but did not become a law. President Lincoln continued to believe that deportation was the only permanent solution of the problem. General B.F. Butler, who had considerable experience in dealing with Negroes in Virginia and Louisiana, was called into consultation by Lincoln soon after the Hampton Roads Conference. Butler says that Lincoln asked him to report upon the feasibility of using the United States Navy, which would soon be free from war service, to deport the Negroes. The president told Butler that he feared more trouble between the North and the South unless we can get rid of the Negroes, especially the Negro soldiers, who he thought were certain to give trouble, that the Southern whites would be disarmed at the end of the war, while the Negroes either had arms or could easily get them from the North, and that a race war might result. The question of the colored troops, Lincoln said, troubled him exceedingly. He believed that all of them should be deported to some fertile country of the tropics. Butler, a few days afterwards, made an oral report in which he made the famous assertion, which is still quoted, that all the vessels in America could not carry away the blacks as fast as Negro babies were born. However, in order to dispose of the Negro troops, Butler proposed that he take them to Panama and use them in digging the canal. One third of them could labour on the canal, one third could raise food, and the other one third could provide shelter, etc. The wives and children of the soldiers could be sent to them. Butler states that Lincoln was impressed by this proposition and asked him to confer with Seward to see if foreign complications were to be feared. Butler wrote out a report which he carried to Seward, who, knowing Lincoln's interest in the problem of the Negro troops, promised to examine the matter carefully. But the murder of Lincoln and the wounding of Seward put an end to this plan. While few practical attempts were made to separate the races, yet much opinion in the North was in favour of it until the end of the war. Especially was this true of the army, which to the last cared little for the Negro per se. This feeling that the blacks should be set apart is shown in the regulations made from 1862 to 1865 by officials controlling the blacks in the Mississippi Valley and on the Atlantic coast, which almost invariably prohibited whites from entering the black communities. Sherman, in his famous Field Order No. 15, setting aside the coasts of Georgia and South Carolina for the Negroes, directed that no whites were to be allowed to live in the Negro districts. Since the close of the war, there has been much discussion of deportation and colonization, but very little effort has been made to colonize. The American Colonization Society kept up its work after the war, but could get only a few hundred Negroes a year. Bishop Turner of the African Methodist Episcopal Church was for years the leading exponent of the colonization idea, and while his views have been endorsed in theory by many of his race, relatively few of them have gone back to Africa. After the failure of the Exodus movement of 1879 to 1882 to Kansas, there was strong sentiment among the Negroes in favour of separate national existence. The United Transatlantic Society, organised during the 80s by one of the Exodus leaders, reflected this feeling but had slight results. One thing that has prejudiced the Negroes against going to Liberia or to other proposed places of settlement is the fact that many swindlers have taken advantage of the various colonization schemes to defraud the Negroes by collecting passage money from them and giving them fraudulent tickets. Negroes who went to Liberia have come back with bad reports of the country. The Negro and the Southern white each, in a way, favour colonisation. Some Negroes would be glad to go if they were sure of doing as well in Africa as in the United States, while every white man would be glad to have the entire black race deported, except, of course, his own labourers. Any organised emigration scheme invariably meets more or less forcible resistance from the employers of black labour. Well, thank you very much for listening, and watch out for more Albion narrations in the future.